You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
You want to play Roman Polanski and girl trying to audition for a movie in a hot tub?
Get ready for the social hour.
Live from Dice World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is The Social Hour. On today's show, motivational speaker and host of the Going in Blind podcast, Zach Tidwell. And now your host. He wrote a motivational book for prison inmates called Going In From Behind, Deese Casillas.
Mullab Keen, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Deese. Thanks for coming back for another episode. We appreciate you being here. If you like what you hear, tell a friend. Let them know. Rate us and review us on your finer podcast apps and the shitty ones. We don't care. Just wherever you listen, we want to be given a quick shout out from you. So thank you very much. Also, guys, as you now know, you can find us now on the Madness Entertainment Network live streaming every other Wednesday at, I think, 1 p.m. Central Time. I don't even know. I'll look it up. It's out there. You can find the information. Just give it a quick goog. Live stream episodes every other week. We are still giving you live audio episodes every single week on our main RSS feeds, deesecomedy.com, our Spotify, etc. So, but if you want to wait, you can catch the audio or the video with a full broadcast on everything. We do comments on it. You can live stream with us, comment, and we are in the chat commenting also when those do go live. So there's a little bit of a lag when it comes to promotional stuff. If you're watching the video, the promotional stuff probably already happened. But for those of you who are listening to this the day it comes out, we have a lot of cool stuff coming up. I will be at the Upstage Comedy Lounge on April 19th at 4:20 p.m. We have our special THC show 4:20 event, the Hilarious Comedy Show, where we get comedians come up, do some time. Then we have them partake in a little bit of cannabis, and then they try to do comedy again. That's a killer show. We're doing a special 4:20 show on 4:19 because 4:20 is Easter, so we'll be spending that day busy repenting for the sins we committed the night prior. Also, I will be at Mexicana Cafe on May 2nd in San Antonio. And then, I'll be in Galveston Bay Brewing in Galveston, Texas on April 24th. Kind of those out of order there. But check the calendar, check the Instagram, go to @deese.comedy on Instagram for updates. And by the time you hear this, guys, we will have Kill Stand number 2 in hand. All the covers will be available. We'll be re-upping all our retailers across Texas and beyond. If you want to order from us directly, you can. If you're out of the area, just hit us up on inferno.earth, the website, or that's our Instagram page. And if you're in the San Antonio area, come visit us at Dragon's Lair in Alamo Ranch on May 3rd for free comic book day. We'll be doing a special drawing for some raffles, some giveaways, some exclusive books we've got we're going to be doing just for that day. And doing a signing and getting Kill Sin number 2 in your hot little hands. So those of you who've been waiting, it will be here. And that's it, guys. Otherwise, go check the calendar, check everything. You know where to go to find out what we're doing. We are going to get into it with our guest today. He is a former Marine, I say you never stop being a Marine, right? A motivational speaker and the host of the Going in Blind podcast. Please welcome Zach Tidwell. Zach, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. 2 hours and some change late.
That's all right.
Totally,
yeah.
messed up my calendar, so I'm sorry for that.
I feel like it's a, you know, we just are doomed to dance this dance of not being on time for shows. Because for those of you who don't know, I did Zach's podcast a couple weeks ago, or I guess that comes out in the future also. And I was also late. So we've got a whole weird thing going on. But it works. We're here now. That's what counts.
Yeah, we're both playing hard to get, and like one day kiss, you know.
That's right. One day, well, in the rain with some romantic music, we'll make it happen. So how you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm staying busy. Thankfully, actually got some sleep. So yeah,
nice, nice, nice.
Been running on fumes lately, and caught up last night, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Where remind me again where you are at, where you're located, what city?
I'm in the Denver Burbs.
Denver Burbs. All right, right on, right on. Yeah. How long have you been in Denver for?
I finished high school out here and enlisted out of here, so I came back here after I got out of the Marines in 2018, but I've kind of bounced around this area for the past, I guess, now. But I guess since then, yeah, kind of bounce around. Also, I just realized I'm lisping. I got Invisalign like 2 days ago, and I haven't figured out how to talk yet. So, yeah, I need to stop saying S's.
Yeah. I like the Denver area, although it gets a little cold for me in the wintertime. I'm not a winter guy, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's seems like a good spot to be a Venezuelan right now, so.
Yeah.
It's going real well out here.
Yeah. So
I had lived downtown for like a year now, I guess about 2 years after I lost my sight, just because it was really convenient for me being able to actually walk everywhere with my cane and not have to take Ubers and stuff like that. But things started getting rowdy and I got the fuck out a year, I guess, with some time to spare, because then things started getting wild.
Yeah, it seems like most major metropolitan downtown areas are getting like that, especially, you know, cities like Denver that are less, just more liberal cities. You know, they're kind of those type of cities are really, their downtown areas are disintegrating quickly. Seattle, Portland, Denver, L.A., San Francisco, things like that.
Yeah, and I've got some acquaintances through my gym that are cops, and they're like, yeah, our hands are kind of tied. Like, you know, some of the stuff we are just, it comes down from us up top that we are not really allowed to enforce. But I think things are, I don't know, it seems like things might be starting to swing back in the other direction. But I don't know. I would imagine you guys have had big issues down there with people coming across, all the borders were open and stuff, right?
Yeah, we certainly did, but you know, Governor Abbott just shipped them all to New York. He's
You're
like,
such you guys, a baller move.
Yeah, he's like, you guys want to be a sanctuary city? Here you go. It's all you, baby. yeah, which is just, you know, it's like hilarious to me, because it's like, yeah, we don't want to deal with this shit. Which, you know, it's so funny, because I understand, and I don't want to sound callous, because you know, I'm the product of immigrants, especially across that southern border, and I understand, and I am all for like a path to citizenship and what that means in this country, but man, yeah, just the millions of undocumented people pouring across the border and having no clue where they're going is not a ideal.
Well, and then they're like, they get sent up to New York and they're like, where the fuck am I? Like, yeah. What's going on? Like, it's not good for anybody for it to be handled that way. So hopefully people start, I don't know. I mean, things are definitely starting to kind of backtrack a little bit, but
yeah. Oh yeah. It's chilled down a lot. Well, I think it's discouraged people from even making the trip. I mean, cause that, like, that's a long, hard trip to, you know, get to the border and try to cross the border into America, no matter what you're talking, even if they're just letting people across. Now imagine with the idea that, oh, that border is not just wide open for you. That's you're way less likely to make that perilous journey if you don't think it would be successful.
Yeah, if you're gonna get sent all the way back to the starting step again, right? Like you make it here, and then they're like, all right, bye. Where'd you come from? We're sending you back. Like,
Yeah, even worse, they might not even send you back to where you started. You might end up in like a Salvadorian prison. You know,
with a bunch of
you could be from
MS-13 homies
Guatemala.
in there.
Yeah, and they're just like, yeah, whatever.
Dude, that is such a scary, and I mean we've seen it now where unfortunately like innocent people have gotten wrapped up with those guys.
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
I mean your life is over.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not coming out of that pit. Like
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, man, I've been to jail in like Mexico, which was something else, but I couldn't imagine be and I'm talking like, local town clinks for a couple nights or whatever, but I couldn't imagine like a Salvadorian prison, what goes on and how rough that is. So, yeah, I mean, if you even survive the experience, that is part of the problem is the people who wanted this kind of change is maybe swung a little too hard at it. Maybe bunt at the pinata a couple times before you go swinging all the way for the Tootsie Pops inside. Because man, a lot of people got wrapped up in stuff that the deportation stuff. Like they deported someone who was like a actual legal citizen from like Colombia, who wrote a pro-Palestine paper, and they deported him. I mean, just shit like that is happening where you're like that's the now we're going too far the other direction,
Well, that, like at that level, I think that's probably some bureaucrat being a dickhead, like a rogue bureaucrat. But either regardless, like this is, people have a tendency like, all right, we went too far in one direction. Now we're gonna go just as far back in the other direction. Eventually, like the pendulum has to settle back in the
Yeah.
middle. But
Well, that I think it, that it, I don't know if the pendulum can settle it. At this point, it's not even swinging back in the other direction equally. It goes further the other direction each time, and then
well, we.
further back the other direction, and further back the other direction, and we just end up in this weird, it's just like with these topics and in political footballs that are getting tossed around and used as a cachet to get votes, and in the end we all get fucked, and all the Congress gets their money from Pfizer still or whatever those fucking people are,
The good news is World War III is coming, so it'll start to take our put our eye back on the ball a little bit.
Yeah, you think so? Where's it coming from? Where do you think?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's. I just. I mean, there's a bunch of proxy wars going on right now. Like, I feel like it's.
Well, yeah.
We're on the cusp, right? This is Cold War. Like, this is the Cold War again, essentially. But it's. If China moves on Taiwan, I feel like everything's gonna fall apart, which I think the only reason they probably haven't is because the TSMC is that semiconductor manufacturer over there in Taiwan, and like they make everybody's chips. So like if that gets taken out, everybody's screwed, China included. So I feel like that might be the only thing saving us there. And then it's not just Russia that we're fucking with. We're fucking with Iran too. Like there, I don't know, man. There's so much. It seems like there's too many little fires sparked up right now that eventually one is going to roll over into something bigger.
Yeah, I mean, it's just all these tiny little wars, like you said, where we're for whatever reason bombing Yemen again. It's like we're gonna go at Yemen, the poorest country in one of the poorest regions of the world. Like, let's blow up Yemen because. And the thing is, like, people are talking about, oh, well, the Houthis were these people were blocking the trade routes, and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, but when we had a ceasefire, they adhered to the ceasefire. But then
They did, yeah.
we broke the ceasefire, and then they're like, well, fuck you guys. So, we're a bit on the cusp of a war with Iran, which it's funny. The thing about Iran is like Iran is the only country that we haven't toppled, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with Wesley Clark when he said that we were going to do like 7 countries in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He's like a 4-star general, Wesley Clark. And after the 9/11, after 9/11, he came out and was like, quote, in his interview and said that, you know, he had seen documents that had stated that the Defense Department wanted to take down 7 countries in 5 years. And it was like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and one other one that we also took down. And the only one that was still on that list is Iraq. So that's the only one we haven't made it to yet. I mean, it took a lot longer than 5 years, but we got, you know, leave it to Americans to take it, you know. Well, bureaucracy moves slow, but we're almost there.
And believe it or not, I'm not a political analyst here, so I could be, I'm definitely speaking out of turn, but I believe the Houthis have traditionally been, traditionally fought against Al-Qaeda, which we have backed. So in the past, like, I don't know, I feel like this is some of the, like, we've been throwing money at Al-Qaeda and like for this whole time. And like, this is recently, like, it more in the last several months, at least, it was the first time that I've heard of this happening, in like millions and millions of dollars a week, I believe, in the tune of like 80 something million, I believe.
Yeah.
And now, you know, it's like, okay, is that why we're starting to fuck up Yemen? I don't know. Kind of, it seems a little squirrely if like we've done this stuff in the past and have, I don't know.
Well,
again, it's like there's so much subterfuge going on here that it's like, especially when that, the fact that we're backing Al-Qaeda is out in the open and like no one from the government, like it's not addressed at the government level. Like, I feel like there's, that there is fuckery going on there.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Why it's not being addressed. And so, you know, that's like a proxy war within proxy wars.
Yeah, I mean people always forget that we are the ones that literally funded it and created the Taliban with Osama bin Laden in the first place, you know, fighting the Santanistas, or you know, the Contras. So it's like we like or training them against Russians and stuff. Like we funded them. We taught them. We armed them. We, you know, the CIA.
We just did again when we pulled out of Afghanistan and left them with tanks and helicopters and munitions. Like, that's a little sus.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that speculate that we did that as kind of a backdoor way to get them in our pocket, you know, because we use Al-Qaeda to fight the Houthis. That's that, you know, we didn't leave it there like whoopsie, we left it there as like, here you go, you know, this is a way for us to pretend like we didn't just give you, we didn't actually arm you, we just, you happen to find this stuff that we left in pristine condition with the keys in it, fully gassed, and after we washed and waxed it,
we botched the pullout.
Yeah,
oops.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's a little crazy. So, but I mean, you've got some experience with this. You were in the military, you were in the Marines. How long were you in the Marines for?
I don't really have experience with it. Like, yeah, I was in the Marines, but none of my deployments were I deployed twice. Neither one of them were to the Middle East, but I was in the Marines for 4 years. It's a pretty standard enlistment. So I enlisted straight out of high school and became a machine gunner. And was stationed in Southern California on Camp Pendleton, which you might be familiar with.
Yep.
And then both of my deployments were into the Pacific. One was spent entirely between a couple islands in Japan, and the other one was based out of Japan, floating around the Pacific. And that was when Kim Jong-un was firing missiles over Japan. And so we were kind of like the, hey, you quit that. Or we're gonna do something kind of just in case something popped off, and like we would have been the first ones to go in. And of course, show of force was all that was required. But
what was that feeling like there? I mean, because you know we know what the news was telling us, but like boots on the ground, what did it feel like? Did it feel real? Did it feel like a credible threat, or was it just like this little Rocket Man ain't doing shit. We got it handled.
You know, it's not, I think, what, I was in E4, and I guess I picked up E5 on that deployment. But, like, you know, you're not at a high level. You're not seeing strategy of anything. But that deployment, it's the 31st MEU. It's a Marine Expeditionary Unit. The Marines are an amphibious force, and obviously we're pulled away from that in the Middle East, but like the Marine Corps is supposed to be an amphibious landing force that goes in and fucks things up, and then the Army comes behind and occupies because they have larger numbers. And
right.
So these rotations, these MEUs are constantly going on around the world. So like the 31st MEU, when we left, another unit took over and went right back out and did basically the same kind of stuff that we were doing. So in a lot of the sense, you're just like, hey, all right, we're over here and we're training, because that is what it turned into. It was jungle training in Okinawa, or training on ship, and then training it now back in Australia. But with that, it was weird, because if something did pop off, I mean, we were just going to get tossed into the meat grinder, and we knew that. And like, we were going to die if that happened. Like, there's a modern military, and you're going to be throwing bodies at them. Like, it's just, that is what would happen. So that was a weird thing, but it's just, you know, I was 21. Yeah, I guess I was 21. Like, it's not, you're just kind of like, hey, that, we're fucked if we go. Hopefully we don't go. But, yeah.
Yeah, great. Yeah. It must be almost more daunting to be in the lower ranks and not know what's going on, not knowing it could come at any time. So, tell people about your story. You have an interesting story and kind of how this came to be with what your motivational speaking and your podcast and stuff like that. So, tell it.
On my second deployment, so I had gotten married in between my first and second deployments. You know, I dated, after I got into the Marines, I started dating a girl that I dated in high school again. And then we made it to the first deployment and seemed to have survived it. So moved in together, you know, moved out to California, moved in together, then proposed and got married before my second deployment to make sure that like she was taken care of. And we were also, since we were gonna get married anyways, yeah, I'm going to get the extra married pay for the 7 months that I'm gone, so that we're set up for success and you're taken care of and you can get school benefits. On near the tail end of that deployment, so like I said, you know, we do basically a unit turnover. So like my unit was the infantry unit on the 31st PU. As we are rotating out, another unit comes in to take our place. And so there's gear turnover of the weapon systems and the vehicles, like the crew serve weapon systems. We would fly with our rifles and stuff and take them over there. But, it was at the tail end of that deployment when we were doing the turnover. So like we were largely back in garrison, and I was also, I needed surgery. I basically had like a hernia, but I needed to get that repaired. So I wasn't going to the field anymore. And one morning, I don't know, we had like a month-ish left in the deployment. One morning I woke up to go outside for PT and check my phone, because we were in the barracks just with like normal Wi-Fi. And I had a Facebook message from a lady that I didn't know. And it was basically saying like, hey, I'm not cool with this. I don't know if you are, but I wanted to let you know, like, here's what your wife and my husband are talking about. And it was screenshots of them talking about fucking. And so I came back from that deployment, tried to make it work with her, and it didn't. So this was January. That deployment was 2017, and I came home at the end of 2017. January, I separated from her and wasn't in a great spot, but I was dealing with it, and I was just keeping myself really busy with the gym and stuff like that. And also on the weekends that we were in garrison, I would take my motorcycle to the racetrack. I was in a nasty motorcycle accident one weekend and had a traumatic brain injury from a wreck. I still don't know what happened that day, and we can get into like the story that I have from it if you want. But basically, gist is that after that, I really started to spiral. And this is crazy. Because looking back, it's so obvious. These are all telltale signs and symptoms or after effects of a TBI. But like, I didn't even think about it. But really started to spiral, really started to ruminate on everything with her. And I couldn't sleep. I started, like, I went from not being happy to I am horrendously depressed and I couldn't sleep. So I found that, you know, a drink or two before bedtime would kind of help me fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And that continued through August of 2018. I was honorably discharged because I finished my enlistment, came home, started going to college. I wanted to become an ER nurse. So I was going to school full time, working full time, and just getting into a worse and worse spot because, like, I realized I was miserable, but I thought, like, all right, this is what happens when your wife cheats on you and you're getting divorced. Like, this is that. And I'm not going to talk about it because that's what bitches do. And I'm not weak. So I just kept self-medicating with alcohol, and that carried on all the way through the end of 2018. And, you know, I was doing everything that I could to keep up appearances that I was all right. Like, to the extent that I would load my dirt bike up and drive to the racetrack and pay to get in and be there. Cause like in doing this in service of trying to make myself get out of the house. Cause I was so just apathetic about everything.
Yeah.
The only things I was consistently doing was working out, going to school and going to work. And so like, I would go to the racetrack, you know, it's a lot of work to load up all your gear and your bike and get there and pay to get in. I get there and be like, man, I really don't want to be here. And then instead of just leaving, I would sit there for a couple hours and so that it looked like I had gone to the racetrack. So I'd sit there for a couple hours and then drive home.
Can I ask you a question, Zach? When you, I'm intrigued by this, like, looking back or like, I mean, maybe looking back isn't the right way to say it. Did you recognize at the time that you were suffering from symptoms of a traumatic brain injury? And like, did you recognize how different you're feeling because of this? Or did you think were you only maybe thinking it was because of the divorce? Or what was like, how were you processing it in the moment, you know?
I noticed like I'm not doing good, but I just thought like, all right, you know, like I said, I'm going through the divorce. That wasn't a great way to find out. That's also not great circumstances under which to have a divorce. Like there's, you know, like growing apart would be a little easier, I feel like, than having that. And just, I just remember realizing or thinking, like, assuming that that's what that was. And as I was getting worse and worse, just thinking, like, all right, this is just, I will get through it because I've gotten through all the stuff that I just did in the Marines just through gritting my way through it.
Yeah. And which is kind of a thing that they promote, you know?
Well, you need it in that environment to.
Sure, sure.
Know, like, there needs to be the ability when when you're in garrison or whatever to be able to speak up with stuff. But there's a very fine line there between like allowing the door. It's hard, you know, you'll get turds that take advantage of shit like that. And that's in any profession, whatever, people take advantage of stuff, but like,
yeah,
you need, especially in the infantry, you need those people to be hard and you need them to shut up and suck it up and make things happen. But yeah, there needs to be that time to like, all right, we're back right now. There's nothing going on. Like what's.
Well, it's hard to transition between, I mean, you get to bounce between those things so seamlessly is not in, it's not human, you know, that's, we're human. People just can't realistically do that easily. So it is very challenging. Yeah. To have to bounce between those two, like mindsets. And one of the other things I want to say is like, I don't think people realize who aren't, you know, I Spent a lot of time on Pendleton. My cousin was stationed there for a long time, and spent a lot of time. I've got a lot of military friends and in different branches, but specifically Marines. I don't think people realize how prolific infidelity and divorce and really chaotic marriages and relationships are in the military, because, you know, yeah. It's like emotions are really high because you have this limited amount of time and you're like leaving for deployment, and you think you love each other, or maybe you do, but you've had limited time together, and then you won't see each other for a while. So it's, you know, it's like this longing, and then you do see each other and it's really hot. And then it's like, you can get that extra pay because of the wedding, or if you have kids and stuff like that.
Very young. Very too.
Right. Yeah. Most people are, you know, 18 to 22 years old, and the money's attractive. Everything about it's attractive, right? To have a wife, and like it just and also if you're getting shipped off to feeling like you potentially could lose your life, you do want to feel like you have someone at home who loves you. Like it all is like a recipe for disaster, but. I mean, literally, there was this girl who used to hang, she was somebody's wife on Pendleton way back in the day. Everyone called her the roller skate girl, and she would literally roller skate around the base during the day and at night and stuff, and like just in skimpy clothing, and I mean, fucking get railed by dudes all day every day. She was someone's husband, and like everyone knew she was just the girl for that. And it's like, this is crazy, you know?
You actually get that a lot. I mean, like you said, the infidelity is very common in both directions, but especially when, yeah, we're gone. Spouses, a lot of times, I mean, it's pretty bad, but you get even where, you know, you'll get a Marine from another unit, or she runs into a Marine at the commissary or something, and like they meet, you know, she's probably lonely, and then he becomes the shoulder to cry on that, like, your husband's gone. And then it's, you know, it's not a shoulder to cry on, it's dick.
Yeah.
It's like, there's this, it's gross, man. But there's this, you know, they call that like Jody got you. Jody is the dude back home who's banging your wife while you're gone. And it really is. It's very prevalent. It's not easy. And you're young and like, you know, and I want to make sure, like what I said a couple of minutes ago about the needing people to be hard. I'm not a combat vet. I'm not trying to like equate my experiences to that. I can't imagine what it's like if you're a dude who got sent to war and like then trying to have to learn that, like, hey, this just like bull in a china shopping your way through things isn't a coping skill. I'm just saying, yeah. You know, I'm just saying this was my experience with like my shortcomings, but with these. On the relationship piece, like in my relationship, our communication was dog shit because we were both young, and like she was the only person I'd been in a long-term relationship with, so I didn't really know how to be in a relationship. So, and she didn't like, she obviously, it came out once I confronted her about her cheating, like had been very unhappy and just hadn't said a thing about it. And so, you know, adults know to talk about those things, but we were so young and just inexperienced. It's,
yeah,
I think that feeds into that. It's that prevalence.
Yeah, it's almost like they should incentivize Marines under 28 years old to not get married. It's like, if you don't get married, we'll pay an extra $1,000 a month or something. Just
so get this, dude. I don't know what single pay was when I picked up E5 because I was married, and then the divorce wasn't finalized until I got out. So I was still getting my like the married pay, and I was just having to split it with her. Like that was part of the divorce. But my E4 pay before I got married was like 800. It was 800 something dollars every 2 weeks.
Which doesn't seem like enough.
you're in the barracks, but like my barracks building was literally called the crack house because the barracks are that shit. There's no, you know, there's, it's just, it's, you're not really taken care of, and there's really not, you don't make very much money at all. It's hard work, and they fuck with you even when you're not out in the field. You know, you'll go, they'll have you leave for the field on a Friday. They'll be like, hey, we're going to the field for 3 weeks. So you go to the field for 3 weeks, and you're just dragging your dick through the dirt for 3 weeks. And you come home on a Sunday or a Monday so that you can work all through the week. And then you get a weekend off, and then like, then you're in the barracks that next weekend. And they're like, hey, we're turning the power off for whatever reason. And it's just like these fuck games. So you're like, I want out of the barracks. So if you've had someone that you're dating, and so like we had dated all the way through my first deployment. So then, you know, we ended up getting an apartment together. She moved out to Southern California, and I was like scraping pennies for us to have this little shitty apartment together. But it was like, I'm out of the barracks. And then things were still going well. And so I was like, all right, I want to make sure she's taken care of and also has access to the health and school benefits here while I'm gone in case something happens. And so, but my pay then went from like $800 and whatever every 2 weeks to like $2,200.
Yeah.
So like it's, I mean, maybe like you said, a countermeasure there would be good. It's tough.
Yeah. I mean, that's a weird proposition also to be like, hey, just don't marry someone. But I mean, you know, it's like also being pragmatic. I mean, when you're like you're going to be in the Marines, you're going to be stuck here. You're going to be deployed for a couple years. Like let's just wait until, you know, you're 28 or whatever, or 26, something. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's just, I just wanted to comment on how that people, I don't think people realize how much that happens and factors into probably some of the depression and after effects of that. Yeah. For soldiers. So you're let's continue on your story then. So you kind of,
I'm faking it. Yeah. That I was doing all right. Yeah. You know, like I said, I was doing that at the racetracks. I was doing the same thing. I would drive a couple hours up to the mountains to go snowboard and then sit in my truck for a couple hours so that it looked like I was snowboarding, because I couldn't force myself to do jack shit outside of working out and my responsibilities. And to me, you know, working out is a responsibility. So like that's why that went hand in hand with those, with work in school. But so March of 2019 rolls around. This is a year after the motorcycle accident, and I just reached the point where I felt like things were inescapable, and it was because I wasn't speaking up and because I was drinking instead. So kind of fueling the fire in addition to stuffing all this shit down. I'm just,
yeah,
it's not a winning combination, kids,
but it turns out.
So on March 27th, and I make a note here to say that I was completely sober this night, because by this point I was drinking most nights, but also the fact that I didn't. So the way the night turned out, I think it makes me wonder if I would have gone through with it on, you know, a couple days later. So March 27th, I cleared my concealed carry firearm out and held it to my head for the first time. And that was first time in my life that I had ever mishandled a firearm, but it was you're not in the same state of mind by the time that you reach the point that you think suicide is the answer. You're just not. You've surpassed any rational thought. And in that insane state of mind, I felt relief because I felt like I finally had a way out of that, again, seemingly inescapable place.
Yeah.
But again, I was totally sober. And so I knew that that would be my way out. I didn't know when, but I knew I had my ticket out. March 30th rolled around. My parents came to my apartment with my two younger sisters and visited and said that I seemed grumpy and tired, but that wasn't really outside of my baseline by that point. Again, yeah. I was that way, very impulsive and agitated in addition to everything else after that motorcycle accident. And also I was working full time and going to school full time. So, but I didn't say jack shit. And we were in my room where I had just held my gun to my head a couple days before. And then on March 31st, I had decided I was going to go through with it. I started recording a video to my family and was finally explaining things for the first time. And
how did that feel?
So like letting it out. I started having some drinks for some liquid courage because I knew what I was about to do. And so, I mean, I was bawling recording this fucking video. And again, the first time that I'd like really shared any of this stuff. And, but in the middle of recording that, and I don't remember this, but I paused the video because my roommate got home early from work at a 2-bedroom apartment with a buddy that I went to high school with. And I went out to the kitchen and talked to him like nothing was wrong. Asked him how his day was and what he was going to do. Like, hey, are you going to get on Xbox later? And he's like, yeah, after I finished dinner and doing my dishes. And so I went back into my room. I guess eventually he wrapped up what he was doing and went back into his. And then he heard a gun go off a couple minutes later. And again, like literally up until minutes before I tried to kill myself, I just acted like everything was fine.
Yeah,
and that is so insane to me. But again, you know, I was drinking that night. And so I wonder sometimes, like, okay, how come I just didn't do that on the 27th when I was just like tinkering with the idea? Like once I realized that was my way out, you know, would I have gone through with that on the 31st if I was sober?
Mm-hmm.
I'll never have that answer, but it's certainly a consideration in that. So that was March 31st. And I guess, again, I don't remember any of this. Apparently I woke up while he was on the phone with 911 and even became combative with the EMTs and paramedics by the time that I got to the hospital. So I got there and got put on life support. And then along that timeline, when they brought me off, I was, you know, it was apparent, all right, he's not going to die. Cause they didn't know if I was going to die at first. Once they knew that I wasn't going to die, they didn't know if I was going to still be me. And it, when I came to, I was, even though I was so out of it that they couldn't get the point across that I was blind. I couldn't see anything, but I couldn't understand the fact that I was blind. So,
right. Well, yeah, I mean, trying to process that in the moment has got to be crazy considering, you know, the compounded head trauma now, along with, you know, your body's in such shock. It's like trying to tell you can't see is like,
well, for days, dude. It wasn't like just okay the first couple of minutes. It was like days where like we could have a conversation like we were having right now. They'd be like, you're blind, and I'd be like, nope. Like, because I could see these weird, I was having very vivid hallucinations of like backdrops or wherever, just environments that I was in, even though I couldn't see the people. So it was pretty wild. And they were actually telling me that I was going to get some sight back in my left eye. That wound up not happening. And so I decided that I wasn't going to become a victim to these circumstances that I had put myself in through my own inaction and in inability to muster the awareness or the courage to speak up. So I started chasing my independence, and I'm totally blind and deaf in one ear, but 8.5 months after I pulled the trigger, I was back in college, or 8.5 months after I pulled the trigger, I was snowboarding again. A month after that, I was back in college, and 6 months after that, I was back out on my own, and I just kept pushing. And there were a lot more struggles along the way. I know we're trying to keep this under an hour, so I'll fly through this and skip over the struggles that came. But along that timeline, I wound up, you know, I ski and rock climb, whitewater kayak. I compete in Brazilian jiu-jitsu against people without any disabilities. I've skydived and surfed, and not that falling out of a plane really requires any sight, but
it's actually more likely if you can't see.
I was like, that was a stupid one to say, but
yeah.
I chased all these things, and actually in the about a year and a half being back into college, I had basically gone to school for 2.5 months to learn how to be blind, and I learned how to use a screen reader on a computer and how to cook, like very basic stuff, and how to use a cane and these other things. But I hit a roadblock in my college education where my school wasn't making any of my materials accessible. And instead, okay, like they're legally obligated to do so. And that had been fine in my English classes, but I got all my English classes and even like the higher level English classes out of the way before I addressed math, because it's not very accessible for people who are blind, given the fact that it is visual, but also the technology isn't really there to make it very accessible. And I'm I enlisted in the Marine Corps to be a machine gunner. I'm obviously not a fucking math whiz. So I avoided that like the plague, but
didn't join the Navy for a reason.
So the college just wasn't doing their due diligence, and instead they assigned someone to be my eyeballs. And that pissed me off because I was fully independent and doing all these other things by this point. And now, like, suddenly I'm beholden to someone again after I had worked so hard to get back on my own. And
yeah,
so I started researching what caused that. And it turns out that it's the software. Every app or website that you're accessing, developers can take specific steps to make their software work for whatever access technology that might be, whether it's voice control software for people with spinal cord injuries, or screen reading software for me, or magnification software for people who are low vision. And it is a huge, the vast majority of websites and apps are inaccessible. So I decided to drop out of college and become part of the solution. And I taught myself how to code in a little under 2 years. And my first app came out in 2023. Won a couple awards for everything that I did. But the big thing with it was that me being totally blind and having never coded a day in my life, when I could see made software that was looked and functioned normally for people without disabilities and was accessible for virtually every physical disability, from color blindness to legal blindness to total blindness to total blindness and total deafness. Like, people can use my software with Braille.
Wow.
To voice control software to voice control features for people with no arms or spinal cord injuries, like I mentioned. And it did all of that. And that, I'd been struggling with alcoholism for like 2.5 years, and that finally started to pull me out of that rut because I'd found my identity and my purpose again. And that kind of leads us into, it won those awards at the end of 2023, and I started writing my book in the middle of January of 2024 because it was clear to me that I was finally going to get sober. At my worst, I was binging for 2 or 3 days straight. I just blacked out for 2 or 3 days, taking 2 or 3 days off, and then doing it all over again. And then, the app first came out and it started doing well, I strung together a month of sobriety and then fell off the wagon, then 2.5 months, and then fell off the wagon for one night. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to get sober. And so I finally wrote the book because I had all these things to say and these lessons that I'd learned and this information that I felt could help people just through putting my experiences out there with my commentary. But even though I knew a lot of these things, I was no longer enacting them because I was leaning into alcohol as a crutch for everything. Yeah. I drank away my ability to cope with stress. So I haven't had a drink since December 5th of 2020. The book is now, I'm about to start the third draft. I've been doing some speaking engagements. That's something I'm trying to do more of and grow more into, especially as the book comes out. And started the podcast, which is called Going in Blind with Zach Tidwell, and is not blindness related. It's just a play on words. I've been working on another software project for about a year now that will hopefully turn into a true startup. And I'm not really going to announce exactly what it is so that people don't.
Yeah.
Know what I'm doing.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, just so much to unpack, Zach. I mean, first of all, I mean, what an accomplishment, right? To get to that point and the motivation, the self-motivation and drive to be able to do that. A lot of people wouldn't be able to. But I want to go back a little bit. I'm curious, like, at what point did it kind of like, did you realize, and how did you process this? What had happened? Like, at what point were you fully back in your faculties and like, oh, I did that. I am blind now. and like having to deal with that and what that meant for you. Like, what did that look like?
Yeah, I apologize for skipping over that.
No, it's all right. Just
make sure I didn't like take too much time.
No, you're good, man.
So I understood from the time that they took me off of life support, like, which obviously, you know, there's some time coming off of that, but like, even when I didn't understand that I was blind, I knew that I shot myself. It was strange. I knew that I had shot myself. I knew that I was in the hospital. I knew that I had a bullet hole in my forehead. I could talk to you. It just, if something wasn't clicking again, like you said, the compounding trauma there, I think probably with all the meds that I was on too, but as I did realize that, it didn't feel like that big of a deal because they were telling me that I was going to get sight back in my left eye. So basically this bridge of my nose here, the lower part of my forehead, my right eye socket, my sinuses were all gone. So that right optic nerve is severed too. They've rebuilt that. That's all titanium plate now, but optic nerve was still intact. And so everyone thought that I was going to get some sight back. And so being deaf in one ear doesn't matter if I'm going to have some sight back. And, you know, if I'm not going to be totally blind, also, like, whatever, I'll figure out how to have one eye. But I was still in the ICU one day. I think this was a couple weeks into me being in the hospital, considering that I was still in the ICU. And so one of the doctors would do their rounds every day. Every morning, and the doctor came in and just like dropped it on me with zero softening, zero warning that like something came back. Like they looked into my eyes the day before and seen that my left optic nerve had died. And so she told me that I was going to be totally blind. And that was like a swift kick to the nuts. But like it was also, you know, that was in the morning. That afternoon when my parents got to the hospital, we started talking about like what my life might look like. And my mom had thrown out like, you can get a guide dog. And my dad did mention like, maybe you could be a therapist. And my response was, I'm not making fucking salt and pepper shakers. And they're like, what are you talking about? And like my mind had snapped because I'd never been around a blind person before.
Mm-hmm.
Never met a blind person. I had seen one legally blind chick while I was in college after I got out of the Marines, but I thought that blind people couldn't do jack shit. I assumed that blind people had to live, you know, with their parents or in a nursing home and like couldn't have real lives. But
I just assumed they all gained extra senses and became superheroes.
Yeah, we start fighting crime on the streets, which you should make your next comic book about.
Yeah, you have radar sense now, right? Is that how it works?
Yeah. Yeah. You'd have like a gay blind dude who develops a sense of like his gaydar and just yeah. laying pipe.
Yeah, just streets, based in San Francisco.
At the Gay Day Parade.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that could be his name, is Gay Day.
Gay Day, yeah. American Pride, we'll call him.
Yeah.
He's a very patriotic superhero.
Yeah, we like that for whatever reason. I remember the salt and pepper shakers in my chow hall on like my area on base on Camp Pendleton in little fine print said made proudly by the blind and visually impaired on them. And my mind was,
oh, that's like, so funny. What an interesting,
memory. I will not have a fucking meaningless job. Like, and again, awesome that those jobs are out there for people who want it, for people who need it.
Did those salt and pepper shakers look like shit? I just imagine them being like these, no, none of them match. They're just amorphous blobs, you know? Like, no, you did a great job. That's great. We'll send this.
They're not
up.
Even made with the same material.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. like an arts and crafts.
Yeah.
But I remember that and I was like, no, fuck that, dude. I am not doing, like, I wanted bigger things for myself, and I would still do that regardless of what I had just done to myself. And that was just that was it for me. I mean, it was then and there. I didn't know what my future would look like, but I was going to do something with a purpose and hopefully use my experience to keep someone else from doing the same dumb shit.
Yeah.
Like, this was obviously a lapse in judgment. And again, I think because you are just not in the same state of mind, like, when you're at that point. And I think, or at least I like to think, if I had heard a story similar to mine now, back then, I probably would have snapped out of it and been like, holy shit, I need to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
So.
The, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, hindsight, no pun intended, is 2020. But, yeah. You know, we don't always get that luxury. So, you know, at least you have that luxury, all things considered. I'm so intrigued as to the in-between time from the moment, you know, you, I assume last thing you remember is pulling the trigger and then waking up. Was there, after being in life support for a couple of weeks, was there any in-between? Was there any come to the light? Was there any, like, other, anything, or it just felt like you were, you know, asleep, not dreaming, and then just, like, closed your eyes and woke, just a couple weeks later, your eyes are open. You had no idea how much time
passed. Yeah, man. It's, unfortunately, I don't have a cool story from that. Like, but, I mean, I woke up, I guess, while he was on the phone with 911. Like, I don't remember any of that. I don't remember being combative with paramedics and the EMTs. Like, and I didn't have, like, your traditional, the near-death experience of, like, yeah, I've come to the light. But I just thought about this. Like, I still don't remember my motorcycle accident. So I wonder, like, okay, like, how much, you know, yeah, I don't know how much more was in there that I just don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, super cool. Brain trauma is crazy. I mean, I've had some pretty severe concussions and had some wild times after that, so I couldn't imagine a hole in my head what that would, you know. It's a whole
dude different. And they kept that, so I was in the hospital for 51 days. I think I had my facial reconstruction at about day 40 ish right around there. They kept the bullet hole open that whole time and packed it with gauze twice a day.
Oh fuck.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah.
Have you this, that, like, I mean, that's so, it's crazy to even think about what, you know, what that process is like, to do. And, like, the, cause, you know, I'm sure it has to heal to a certain amount before they can even consider reconstructive processes.
Yeah. And so because of where I shot myself, so it was basically like a hole into my sinuses, and then that went, none of the bullet entered my brain. So I have bullet fragments inside of my skull, but none of it entered my brain. So it did, you know, breach my sinuses too. But
how in the hell did they not hit your brain at all?
I had hollow points in there. I really think
splintered.
That's what saved me.
Yeah, yeah.
It was
slug.
My concealed carry firearm, and I wasn't apparently in a present enough state of mind to be like, hey, I should load a ball round in there, not
the, yeah, yeah, probably point. Just hit that cartilage and blew up.
Yeah,
which, goddamn, I mean, you know, which is crazy, because depending on how that ricochets, that could have been worse in your situation. You could have lived and had severe brain damage, you know, as opposed to lived and, you know, still be cognizant.
Well, and that's actually why I'm deaf in my right ear. There's bullet fragments in my inner ear on that, right? So, like, that's where some of them settled. But I guess said a lot of it left my face. There's some of it, like, along with that bone that was ejected when everything kind of blew out. And then some of it is back by my right carotid artery. And I built, that's, like, those are the only pieces that I'm aware of that are still in there.
Is it anything that they worry about giving you other side effects down the road, or is it just kind of, it is what it is?
No. And I asked about that early on, specifically about lead poisoning and stuff like that. They said, your body is actually your body wards that stuff off. And so I don't know what it would, I don't know if it's tissue. I mean, I would imagine it's scar tissue in my ear, but, like, the piece that's back by my right carotid artery, I don't know what it cordons those kinds of things off with, but apparently your body's capable of handling that stuff.
So do you have to like have a special card when you go through TSA now? To set, where they're like set off the metal detector and you're like, hey, sorry, I have bullet fragments inside of
me. I just tell them, I'm like, hey man, this might, you know, I got metal in me. And they ask me a lot because I go through the GIMP line for security because I travel alone most of the time. So they know.
What about, this is always fascinating me too, the difference between people who are born blind and people who become blind. You know, like, obviously they both can't see, but you can, you know, you tell a blind person what a tree is and they're like, well, fucking, how did you, like, I assume if they've never had sight, they, I don't even know if their mind is forming pictures that can, you know, like, I don't know how that would even work. Whereas you have seen things. So there's got to be at least some, I mean, at least advantageously, like being able to you know what I'm saying? Like,
I can give you a wild one here. So, and I can talk about this and then kind of talk about, I guess, my stuff. But so along the path of me kind of relearning things, the people who do like blind rehab instructors all have at least master's degrees in the field. Like that's the bare minimum to be in the field of blind rehab. So these are, you know, they're very committed, but they work in that very narrow lane of like, okay, I'm an orientation and mobility instructor who teaches the cane skills, or living skills instructor who teaches cooking and stuff like that. I had one of my instructors had mentioned, I don't even remember how this came up, but to your comment on them not even having remotely like a reference for things. You know, when you teach a blind child what an elephant is, you show them a toy elephant. So the scale for that they have, even if you tell them like, oh, this thing's as tall as three horses. Okay, well, they don't know what the fuck, how big a horse is. You know, like, a lot of it is stuff like that, from my understanding. And then also, obviously, you don't know what a color is. So that's got to be wild. Actually, I don't know that many people who were born visually impaired. And especially the total blindness is very rare. It's not very common. Mm. So, but in my experience, I definitely, first of all, I remember what things look like, which I'm very thankful for. It is weird though, when I dream, a lot of times I can see, but it's very diminished because it's like, I know that I should be blind, but then I can see some and I'm like, how come people don't know that I can see some?
Interesting.
Or I'll see normally and be like, wait, I'm blind, and then it'll go black, or I'll wake up, and it's very strange. But I think it really helps me more like with jujitsu, like when I compete. You know, I've been an athlete my entire life. I wrestled in high school, and now with this, I know how people move because I've seen it. Like, it's for stuff like that, I think it's a huge advantage. And even just mapping things out, like people talk about your hearing getting really sensitive, and like my one good ear has definitely gotten very sensitive, but like my ability to, my spatial awareness and my ability to map things out in my head, I feel like is like the biggest thing. And just general awareness of where I am in space, even if I'm outside cruising around with my cane and I get lost somewhere, is very like, I feel like I've become very in tune with things like that.
Yeah. What's the craziest thing that's ever happened while you, since this, like, because of being blind, like, you know, like fell into a manhole or something, you know, like what's the craziest thing that's happened to you because of this in that regards? Like you end up in the wrong part of town or something.
I mean, you got to picture this, dude, like, especially so when I first got back out on my own, I kind of did it with training wheels. I moved onto my college campus and I moved into the dorm so that I was alone, but I still had people around.
Right.
I mean, you probably come out to Denver for comedy, but I doubt you're like that familiar with the town. There's a giant college campus in downtown Denver.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yep.
My gym, the campus gym, was on the complete opposite side of the campus for me. And so like, When I got tired of being in the dorms for like the first week or two I was there, I was just working out in the campus or in the dorm building gym. And like, it's like a hotel gym. I mean, if you're serious about working out, it's not a gym. And so I was like, you know, fuck this. I'm tired of being scared of leaving here. I'm going to walk across campus and get to the gym. And like, I'd been shown how to do it, but I hadn't done it on my own. And of course I got lost. And like, being lost in a city, especially like, I had gotten the RA at the front desk had gotten his phone number so I could FaceTime him in case I got lost. So I called him thinking I'm going to get bailed out, and I'm trying to FaceTime him. And I'm like, hey, I know there should be like the Tivoli building with the, you know, like the kind of peak on top of it, like to my southwest. Do you see it? And he's like, what do you mean southwest? I'm like, fuck, like this dude doesn't know his cardinal directions. Like that's the whole way that I'm operating. Like, stuff like that, getting lost is, I mean, I haven't had anything where like, oh, I fell into something, but just getting lost in a city and you're completely blind, like that feeling is the worst feeling. And it's happened multiple times. I mean, that's just part of the game, but like, yeah, it's scary.
Yeah, I imagine it's a crazy circumstance. Though luckily, hopefully people are pretty sympathetic to that and helpful. So
on the college campus, I would just get ignored sometimes when I was asking people. Jeez. I think this was mid COVID, and it, you know, I'm picturing that it's a lone female and there's a dude being like, hey, can you help me? Like, yeah, I would ignore you too.
Yeah.
Like if they don't realize I'm blind.
They're like, I know this game, the old pretend he's blind game.
Yeah. Ted Bundy.
Yeah. 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 Can you help me lift this into the back of my truck? So what about, let's talk about before we get out of here, we got a little, how about navigating this with like friends and family. And I don't even mean the after effect of, you know, being blind so much as, you know, what physically happened to get you there. Cause I mean, I know personally, my best friend, another comic, I think we might talk about this on the, on your show. But you know, he took his own life, and it was something that, you know, it was one of those things where I had driven him to the hospital on attempts and visited him in the hospital after attempts. And it was a matter of when, not if, you know, and you just try to kick that can down the road as far as you can and hope things get better. And when it happened, I really was, because I was the one who had to call people and let them know, and was the person in the town. So, you know, family is calling me, his mom's calling me, friends are calling me, and I have to like relive it over and over and over again for just months. Right. And it was just, you know, so I can only imagine you being the person it happened to and trying to deal with this in the aftermath, talking to people. I mean, what was that like? Those relationships with your friends and family and discussing it, and how did that change for the better or worse with relationships with certain people?
So I'm going to try and be careful about some of this, but
sure. Yeah. I mean, say so, as much as you, or as little as you want, but that's,
yeah, I'm comfortable. I just, yeah. So like, I don't have, you know, I haven't talked to my roommate about this, but I just know that, you know, we don't see each other anymore, and our relationship just kind of faded into obscurity. So
you never talked to them again after?
I saw him. I think he visited me twice in the hospital. It was either once or twice. And it was like, I remember just crazily, like I was on it. I was mad at him while I was there. I was like, how come this fucking dude won't like, come on, man. I got a bullet hole in my head, which is, now I understand, like, that probably fucked him up. He wasn't in the military. He's like,
yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot. And, you know, I know he had some, I know, like, he wound up getting a DUI later on. I'm sure it was probably tied to that. You know, he's drowned in some stuff, but then that sucks. Family stuff, I would say my family for the most part started to do better as I did better. And of course, that kind of, some of that was almost like not false progress early on, but no, I reached a point in the beginning of 2021/late 2020 for several months where I was suicidal. Like everything finally hit me in my life in terms of how hard things were. And I was back out on my own at that point, but just everything is fucking hard, dude. And like, just took me so much time, and it finally settled in on how different my life was going to be. And I told everyone, and I, including my therapist, and finally, like, actually worked through that. And that was the first time that I've ever worked through a depressive episode, even though it lasted months, but I got out of it.
So you were at a point where you were considering suicide again.
I was having thoughts of it, and I saw where that was going, and I did not want, I knew, I, for whatever reason, I had this feeling that I did not want to live, but I didn't want to kill myself. Like I okay. felt like I wanted to die, but I knew, like, you know, like I wasn't going to do that to myself, and I wasn't going to put my family through that again.
Yeah.
And so it was several months there, and I went from talking with my therapist once a week to every day, and sometimes multiple times a day throughout that period. I mean, it was bad, but that was the first time that I ever actually worked through that. And that was a huge learning point for me, where I'm like, okay, you can get through these things, and it's going to suck, and it is a lot of work, and it's very uncomfortable, and it's not easy, but I did it. And so that has carried me forward through today. But I wound up, like I said, I fell into alcoholism for 2.5 years, and I got diagnosed with Huntington's disease along the way with that. And I really just, as the drinking got worse, you know, I threw away two serious relationships that I was in, and then it put my parents through a lot, I think, just with worrying about me. And like today, I don't really have a relationship with my mom. That actually fell apart after, or actually, no, I guess that fell apart. I'm trying to think. Yeah, that fell apart after I got sober. But like, you know, there was some resentment kind of pent up around all this stuff, and that's not, I don't really want to air out family drama. Sure. So like, that's as far as I'll go with that. But yeah, it's been a lot, you know. It's, but in general, it's been, as I've done better, whether that was the phase early on as I was getting my independence back, or as I got sober, I think everyone around me has done better seeing that I am doing better.
Yeah, that's good. It's just, I'm so curious, because it's such an interesting thing, the way it affects everyone else around the scenario too, you know. It's funny, because like, I have other comic friends who were also close with the guy we know that, you know, took his own life. They were very close with him, and we were all this tight-knit group, and some of them, like, stopped talking to me. And I think with some of them, not stop talking to me, but stop doing comedy and stop talking to all of us. And it just kind of like, I think it's just like too hard to
separate from it entirely.
Yep. So, and so, you know, which was tough, because there was a couple people where it was like, you know, people I was some of best friends for years. And it's like, you kind of have to be like, I guess that's what you need, you know? So,
I mean, everyone has to deal with it in their own way, which is, you know, you hope they're doing it in a productive way, whether, you know, it's not withdrawing into a bottle or expressing that in some other behavior that's not going to be good in the long run. But you just kind of got to let people process it and be there for them if they need help.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, one of them just got gay married, which is arguably worse. So, no, I'm kidding. I love her to death, and there's been a couple text exchanges over the years, but it's someone I used to talk to and see, you know, a couple times a week, and it's like, you know, so, yeah, man. I mean, it's a crazy story of yours, and I appreciate you sharing it. And really, it's I'm sure you don't necessarily look at it this way, but it's something that people should be, you know, inspired by and look at is that no matter what the circumstances, man, there's a chance to pivot and a chance to find some good and stuff and push forward into what you want to do and make something good out of it.
Thanks, man. And it's, you know, the hope is opening up discussions around this stuff. Like, these are uncomfortable topics, right? Even like you double checked with me beforehand that I was even comfortable talking about all this stuff. And these are conversations that need to be had more. And there's hopefully, you know, people can extract something from this where it's okay, I need to get help, or realizing, you know, at the end of the day, like for me, it's, I'm the reason I got here. Like these people, whether if you're struggling with something, like you still have agency to do something about it. And
yeah,
that is ultimately on you. That's not on anyone else if you don't help yourself. And no one can help you if you don't tell them that you're hurting, or if you're the, you know, the family member that's left behind, realizing that like this is not your fault, or like for you, like your friend, like you were trying to help. If you did everything you can, you did everything you can. Like, that is unfortunately on him. Or same thing with addicts and alcoholics. Like, it's okay to set boundaries and walk away. And it's just,
yeah,
some of this stuff is the nastier parts of life, but people need to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunate. You can only do as much as you can do. And, you know, people have their prerogatives and are going to do what they ultimately want to do also. So,
like getting married at 18 in the Marines.
Yeah. yeah, there's you know, a lot of bad choices along the way, right?
Yeah.
Well, Zach, I appreciate you sharing your story. Like I said, it's you know, inspirational for people, or at least it should be if they're listening, for those who hear it. And for those who want to hear more from Zach, subscribe to this podcast, Going in Blind. Tell us where they can find you and the show, when it comes out, all that stuff too.
Yeah, the show comes out every Monday and also the first Friday of every month. It's called Going in Blind with Zach Tidwell. Got all sorts of people coming on, and Deese was also on there. That this will actually air before your episode airs on mine. I recorded a decent buffer there between episodes.
Yeah.
So there's that. I've got my website at zachtidwell.net, and the important thing there, reach out to me for speaking stuff, but also I have a mailing list that is, if you want to be kept up to news with the book as that hopefully hits the road to publishing, that's the place to be kept up to date with that. But outside of that, you can just kind of Google me and follow me on all the socials that way.
All right. Well, guys, check him out. Check out the podcast. Take a listen. Subscribe to his newsletter. Keep up on the upcoming book, all that. And yeah, get a little daily dose of some inspiration for you guys. So beyond that, guys, we are going to get out of here for this week. Again, go to deesecomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network, live dates, podcasts, and also Kill Stand number 2, which will be available as you hear this. So if you didn't pre-order your copy, hit us up and we will get you your copies. We've got 4 covers available as of right now. One of them is a limited edition. We only printed 25 copies, so you got to get that while you can. Those will go fast. So that's it, guys, for the Social Hour. I've been Deese, for Zach, thank you very much, everyone, and we will see you all next week.